Sitting here with James Durden, one of the leading lights in higher categories and so on. James, I'd like to get your kind of higher, bigger picture opinion on the state of some of the mathematics at the moment in some sense, or at least you were involved with John Byers in setting up HDA0, higher dimensional algebra, topological quantum field theory.
HDA0, that's the name of a particular paper. I'd really have to try to remember which is which. I'm not very good at remembering which is which.
It sets out the kind of grand program of categorification in the mid-90s. And to some extent, well, this program has been developed to a very large degree, and to some extent the very existence of this constant can be traced back to those ideas that we had in the mid-90s.
I think of, you know, practically any paper that has appeared as a joint paper between me and John. I certainly, from my perspective now, certainly I always think of those papers as John's papers. That they present more of his point of view than my point of view. You know, it would just be it's sort of a very difficult task trying to keep up with John in terms of writing things down and you know, there might have been times when I did try to make sure that my viewpoint was being expressed, but I quickly found out that it wasn't easy to do that, and I kind of stopped trying at some point. And you know, looking back at whatever papers appeared as joint papers between the two of us, I think of them as his papers, really, in a way.
Right.
But by now I've probably forgotten the original question. I probably just make that point. Have I already forgotten the specific question?
I think you already almost partially answered the question. The question was really to kind of get to the bottom of...
Well, yeah, you did ask something sort of about the tracing the sort of genesis of this, of the kind of things that are going on conference back to that paper and things like that.
I think
it probably is true that there was this influence, for good or ill. I think it is true, you know, despite or maybe because of the often ridiculously incomplete nature of things in a lot of those early papers that John wrote with some involvement from me. You know, incomplete and vague ideas that were expressed in them many times. The way I see things going, the way I see some of these programs being developed, things being played out,
To what extent does that correspond with your original grand vision?
in very weird ways.
That's what I'd like to
say. I mean, I feel very much like a spectator, and I'm curious about which way it's going to go. Sometimes it goes in ways that strike me as along the lines of what I originally thought, and sometimes it goes in pretty different ways, and I'm sort of shocked at the directions it goes sometimes.
Can you give examples of that?
Let's see. It's sort of it's very tricky to give examples, but often you know, often when I see some very beautiful development of the subject, I think, oh yeah, that's what I originally had in mind,
So what's beautiful and what's ugly at the moment?
Well, I mean, and you know, it's easy to think of some pretty beautiful things. I mean, Joyal's whole theory of quasi-categories. I should say, Joyal gave this very interesting talk on quasi-categories at this conference, and I haven't really had a chance to talk with anybody about it yet. In fact, I probably missed some opportunity. I probably could have asked Joyal himself about some of it, although I had a feeling I wasn't really prepared to. I had a feeling I would have to. One thing I really do like about John is talking things over with him at a level. At the level of, you know, asking really stupid questions and things like that, and I haven't had a chance to talk with John about that. I mean, there were some things that Joyal said it in his talk that had me really puzzled. But it could have been based on stupid misunderstandings. I may have misheard what he said or something. This whole business I'm talking about reduced categories and how it relates to quasi-categories and things like that. I've been meaning to talk that over with John. I'm sort of very puzzled about some things that are going on there.
Right. Now, what about quasi-categories, or do you like? Is it one of your favorite models of infinity categories? Or?
Well, it's just infinity, comma, one categories. So in a way, it's just a very mild step on the road to further things that you could hope to develop. But it is very beautifully done. I'm not sure I can add too much. I mean, when Joyal talks about it, he often expresses how beautiful it is, and he's right, and I very much agree with what he says. And it is interesting that so I guess Joyal attributes the definition to Boardman and Vogt, I guess.
Right.
And I remember, in fact, you know, before the publication of HDA Zero, I think it was before the publication, a long time ago, when John and I were, you know, first starting to think about silly ideas about N categories, and you know, not that we were like the first, but that we were doing it in great ignorance of what practically anybody else had done, thinking along those lines.
Right.
And at one point, I remember we were just floundering around. We had no idea what had already been done. And at one point, and again, this was long enough ago that it's hard to remember what the internet was like back then, but I guess there was some sort of forum on which John posted a question, basically sort of asking some sort of mathematical forum. Maybe it was the categories mailing list. It could have been the categories mailing list.
Right.
And he asked a question something to the effect of, has anybody developed a general theory of weekend categories, or something like that? I think the question was something along those lines. And there were probably several responses, and one of them was from whatever his name is, Reiner Vogt, is that his name? Vogt?
I'm not sure.
Boardman and Vogt, the Vogt of, I guess his name is, I thought it was Reiner Vogt or something like that.
I see.
And he answered, and he answered John's query, and he answered it with this definition that apparently Joyal has now adopted as the definition of quasi-categories.
That goes back way back then.
Yes, and Joyal attributes it to way back
right.
then. And when we say way back then, we mean way back before this. But I mean,
right.
this was the first time we heard about it when he answered this query on
right.
the mailing list. And our response at the time was, well, first of all, we just kind of scratched our head and tried to figure out what the hell he was talking about. We couldn't tell at first whether he was talking. You know, we had no idea. I mean, our goal for weekend categories at that time was that it should be, you know, I guess what in this jargon we would now call it infinity comma infinity categories.
Right, right.
And so it took us a while to figure out that what Vogt was saying was just intended to serve as the infinity comma one categories.
I see.
And so, you know, I mean, it's sort of amusing looking back at our attempt to figure out what was going on and our response when we sort of figured out what was going on. So, you know, I'm sure at a certain point we sort of said to ourselves, oh, so he's only trying
right,
to do
right,
the
right.
infinity comma one case, you know.
And then
we had set this ridiculously
yeah.
goal for ourselves. And I guess that's a typical thing. Often we set very ambitious goals for ourselves. We like to set them so ambitious that, you know, there's just no shame in failing at them, which we always do. And although we always seem to discover that when we thought that we were being ridiculously ambitious, we usually discover later on that we weren't really being ambitious at all. I mean, it often turns out that, you know, things that we thought were ridiculously ambitious goals had actually been done, you know, 10 years earlier,
right.
20 years earlier, some obscure place.
Can you give an example of that?
We ran into a case of that recently. I'm trying to remember what it was.
Oh, well,
this is a little bit imprecise and vague, but there was a concept, there's this concept that John and I have pulled around a lot with under various names, sometimes called cuboid cardinality or
right.
homotopic cardinality. And at the time that when we were thinking about these ideas, we had the feeling that we were doing really strange and bizarre stuff. You know, like, you know, the idea of finding something which, when you count it, you get the answer E, you know, the number E.
Right.
That seems like a really
yeah.
strange thing to do. And we were sort of, you know, we really enjoyed the idea that we were, you know, on the edge of the bizarre. And you know, as we later found out, these ideas are really not bizarre, and they're really not even new. We've just found so many ways in which
who was the first
these
human?
Ideas have been anticipated.
Yeah.
Well, the ideas have been anticipated in so many different ways that it's hard to say.
I see.
So what are some examples that we found out where these ideas have been anticipated? Well, so one example is at one point we were just looking for examples of spaces that had peculiar cardinalities, and we started looking at surfaces, you know, surfaces of genus N, and there's various nice ways of calculating.
Well, right, right. Well, one thing that happens, of course, you can simply take
the Euler characteristic of a surface. But the funny thing is, there's a way to interpret the Euler characteristic of a surface as the I forget what the jargon is, but the sum of the divergent series that you get by counting the number of elements in the fundamental group.
All right.
It's weird that you get the Euler characteristic, which is typically a negative number, I guess, for certain genus, the entire genus. Let's see, is it... actually, I'm sorry, I guess you're getting... Where am I confused? Do we get a reciprocal? Yeah, I guess we get the reciprocal of the Euler characteristic. Is that right? Yeah, that's right, right, because you interpret the Euler characteristic as the reciprocal of the size of the fundamental group.
Right.
And then the Euler characteristic itself is a negative number, I guess. So we're adding up, you know, we're summing a divergent series of natural numbers, and we're getting, as a result, a number that's both negative and a fraction.
Right.
And we thought that,
weird and new.
We thought we were just violating all sorts of rules. And, you know, much later we found out that, you know, this was completely developed, really, by other people, and well understood, in a way, these divergent series and the circumstances under which you can make sense of it.
Right.
And we just had this general feeling that, you know, every time we thought we were doing something on the edge, we were nowhere near the edge. That had all been anticipated.
Now, James, what I'd like to know is, you and John, I understand, made a definition of weak N categories and sent it in a letter to Ross Street. Could you just tell us a little bit more about that, and why you chose to send it in the letter in that way?
Okay. Well, so let's see. So how did that happen? So we had been working on this stuff, although a lot of it was me working by myself on it while John was sort of gallivanting around the world. Like to Australia. And you know, I sometimes tell John, you know, how much progress I thought I was making and things like that. And he would this is an absolute fact about John, that he overhyped everything.
Okay.
And he you know, one thing he did was he overhyped I can see where he would try and blame me for it. He would try and say, "Well, you said you had this definition." I said, "Yeah, well, I thought I did, but you know, I didn't mean for you to tell everybody that." And you know, so one day he told me, you know, I guess he had come back from Australia, or he was emailing me from Australia. I think it was after he got back from Australia, and he told me all about how he had told all the people in Australia that we had this definition of weak N category. And, you know, I was sort of...
So you felt compelled to...
Well, I was very non-committal about it. I forget whether I said anything to him like, you know, why did you tell him that? Or anything like that. But, you know, in the back of my mind, certainly, I'm thinking, you know, what the hell is going on here? I mean, you know, like... I mean, I never mind this particular incident. I definitely had the general experience a number of times of situations where
John would hop it up and you'd feel uncomfortable.
Well, yes, but another phenomenon that would happen is that John and I would be talking about things, and we'd have lots of fun talking, and I would tell him something as a joke. And later I would see it written in a paper as a serious thing.
any examples of that?
I could probably find some. There's probably some example that I'm thinking of that has to do with... I mean, it's probably just some pedagogical example or something like that. Some of these examples I'm thinking of are things that, I mean, some of it is that. When I say things that I would say as a joke, I mean, there are things that I would say as a joke, but also seriously use as a joke in trying to teach people. And so, you know, so sometimes he would steal my joke that I would use for teaching purposes, and we'd put them into papers or something like that. And I was always very ambivalent about that because I don't think of myself as like a creative researcher or anything like that. I think of myself basically as a teacher. And one of the problems of working with John is that people really, really get the impression that like I don't like to communicate with other people, and they think, you know, that I just like to have John speak for me. I don't like that at all.
What would you prefer? I mean, what situation would work better for you?
Just that, you know, I would really like to teach people. For example, there was a recent...
Teaching your research or teaching kind of mathematics that are...
Both. I mean, there was a time when I was, you know... When I started out, when I just sort of didn't have to worry about there being a gap between the kind of things I was working on and the kind of things, you know, when I started out, I didn't know that much, so I was kind of at the same level where, you know, I could just, the things I wanted to teach
Have you given any talks at conferences recently, or?
Only some very informal talks at Minneapolis that I remember.
Okay.
So sometime in the last year or so, I remember there was a year or two, I don't remember exactly, but there was some sort of... John went to Chicago to give some sort of series of talks, and the way I found out about it was like the day or so before he left, he told me, by the way, I'm in Chicago, I'm going to give some lectures, and the way he phrased it, he said something like, oh, and by the way, the stuff that I'm going to be talking about is basically direct steal of all your ideas. That's what you phrased it.
Is this the lectures on cohomology?
On what?
N categories and cohomology.
Is that what it was called?
I think it was. I think he said in the beginning that he learned not from Jim.
Well, if it's what I'm thinking of, he mentions me, but he also mentions somebody else. He mainly says that none of it is his ideas, but then he mentioned several people.
Grothendieck, wasn't that? It was you and Grothendieck.
I don't know. It was some other people that he was talking about. I forget exactly. But is it really just N categories and cohomology? I remember it as being cohomology and something else, but I can't remember what it was. I don't know. I can't remember what it was. But...
So you wouldn't, you don't like that kind of situation when he just pops it on you at the last moment.
Well,
I mean, someone's got to say these ideas. I mean,
it's not the last moment thing that bothers me. It's this idea that I don't like the idea of, I just would really like to, you know, the chance to do it myself rather than have people. I really dislike the idea that people think that I'm deliberately letting him speak for me. That's not true at all.
Okay. Thanks for clearing that up, because I also was wondering about that.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I was trying to answer various questions here, and I've already forgotten.
No, you've done. I think I've just got one more question to ask. Your definition of higher categories is that's definition.
That's probably part of what you started at.
Right, and why you sent it to Ross. So he sent it to me. He had actually done it since definition.
Yeah. Right, well, okay, and I just want to make one more comment.
Right,
that.
Right,
that's
okay,
a definition.
Okay, okay, okay.
In particular, you asked about the letter to Ross. So, guess that when I was writing that letter to Ross, I was trying to, I mean, I think I think the letter to Ross is like from both John and me.
Right, yes.
And I think in the letter, I think there's a detectable difference in tone between John's part of it and my part of it. And
right.
I think, like, I'm trying to be very reticent, and I'm trying to emphasize the fact that, you know, well, we were trying to do stuff, but, you know, we're not sure how well it worked out, and, you know.
Is your personality sounding too?
Well, I mean, actually, I think that's the way John thought of it back then. He was always saying things like, "Now, well, why are you being so overcautious?" He was always being overcautious.
Right.
I wasn't being overcautious at all. Yeah. I mean, I think he just didn't realize how uncautious I was being sometimes.
So you weren't completely convinced by your own definition of?
Well, yes, absolutely right. I mean, there were so many things I was worried about. And in particular, well, I mean, there are so many different ways that I could have been and was worried about it. I mean, you could be worried about things being, you know, aspects of, you know, you could worry about things in favor of being correct, but beyond that, you can also worry about whether it's a good definition or something like that.
Right.
I think in general, in joint work between John and me, I think, and again, I think this is an aspect again of how I claim that sort of, I'm not trying to be cautious in framing my description of what John is like, but I mean, I described it before as he overhypes everything. I'm not sure that's the right way of saying it exactly, but something like that is true. And in particular, in like one of the feelings that I've always had about joint work between him and me is that he never gives a sense of how so much of the stuff that we're working on is, how do I describe it? It's like
still in the air, or
is what
still in the air?
In the what?
In the air, as in it's
air.
It hasn't been completely finalized yet, or
yes, very much so. Yes, but I really had trouble understanding the word.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
But how was I going to turn it? I think he just doesn't give a sense of when it is that he and I are just, you know, completely pulling stuff out of the sky and just, you know, we have no idea what we're doing. He like makes it sound like we know what we're doing and there's a plan, and there just isn't. We just have no idea what we're doing. We're just completely faking it. And he doesn't, you know, he always papers that over. And I think he does this with everybody. And I've been talking to various people about, you know, like when they read descriptions in, you know, John's internet columns and things like that about, you know, John writes descriptions of some work that they've done where he's heard some talk that they've given, something like that. And I've heard lots of people say, you know, that there's an amusing difference between, you know, what they actually did and how they felt about it and how they hear John report on it.
Right. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. Uh-huh. Thank you very much.
Using your teaching stories and then writing them in their papers.
Is that why you do that?
Yeah, well, I say it from you. I mean, maybe you don't like the way I'm attributing it to you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this is what James told me.
No, it's just that the thing is, I'm a frustrated teacher. I'm not employed as a teacher. I think I'm a great teacher, and I'm not employed as a teacher. I think it's kind of tragic, that's all.
I said walking terminal. I had a paper about the walking
imminent. I remember that one, about the hairy ass. Did that come from you originally?
Yes. That's probably the original example.
Okay.
You know, I said there are these examples where I say things as a joke, and then I read John writing them seriously in the paper. That's probably the original example that I had in mind.
Okay,
something that I thought was, you know, good enough for, you know,
casual
discussion
in a classroom in front of a bunch of students who don't know any better.
So, Aaron, can you just explain for the listeners what that joke was about?
Oh, the walking?
Yes.
Yes,
the walking.
How it became a joke? The actual
idea of the joke. I mean,
he's mentioning the example of the eyebrows.
Yeah, the eyebrows.
I
probably told it different ways. I mean, for some reason, I associate this with. I mean, I probably you didn't mention Ernie Kovacs.
No,
Ernie Kovacs didn't even have like really bushy eyebrows. I think that was the example he used when originally telling John this, and that like sometimes I'm not sure where I got this example. Maybe it would be like ruder if I had talked about somebody with a big nose or something. Eyebrows seems very
neutral.
Yeah, but just the example, just if we're talking to the typical, it's just. If somebody has like a really bushy pair of eyebrows, you might refer to them as like a walking pair of eyebrows. This is sort of an illustration of the concept of a universe. Concept of a, I guess, let's see, I mean, the terminology parses in different ways.
Right.
The concept of a universal property in general, generic thing in general. I'd have to think about it seriously. Yeah, about a good way to
put it. He's nothing else but his eyebrows, basically.
Yeah.
He's just a body that exists to uphold
just
the eyebrows.
Yeah, just uphold the eyebrows.
So I did several talks on this with the walking junction. But one time I was giving a talk, the walking pair of eyebrows was in the audience. So that was I had to rethink it after that.
Now, James, any final things you'd like to have set straight for the record?
No, not that I could be inspired.
Okay.
That's the ice.
Okay.
I'd have to think a long time before something it out.
Okay. We're not going to.
Are you becoming an incategorical journalist? Something like a problem now?
Well, the incategorical yellow square.
Okay, thank you very much.